Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Yes, kia ora MOTAT and kia ora Ellen. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. It is a beautiful day outside and it's good to be here.
You really enjoyed that bit about that intro there.
I certainly did, you know.
That family first bit.
Very good, very good.
Well, so you're here today, yes. We're continuing our chat about Nobel Prizes. I understand the award for chemistry has been announced recently, and it's for the discovery of CRISPR. Now, I remember someone doing a speech about this in high school, so I have a vague understanding of CRISPR. But could you please, for all of us, kind of give a bit of a refresher?
Well, I'd say I have a vague understanding of CRISPR as well, I think. So as you so rightly say, the award for chemistry was made last Wednesday, and of course all us chemists sat up watching the live stream, which you always do, because it's kind of the highlight of the year. And this was the first time that two women have won the Nobel Prize in chemistry, and that takes the number of women who've won the Nobel Prize in chemistry to a whopping 7. But it's getting better, obviously. So the woman in question, Jennifer Doudna, she's at UC Berkeley and the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and Emmanuel Charpentier, who's at the Max Planck Institute in Berlin. And the citation for their Nobel Prize was, quote, for the development of gene editing, which is quite a big thing, really. And it's not really the sort of thing that you might associate perhaps with chemistry, because it's got a very sort of biological bent. However, what we've seen in the last, 20, 30 years, I guess, of Nobel Prizes is that quite often now the Nobel Prize for Chemistry goes to biologically related subjects, simply because biology and life and all of that sort of stuff is at its fundamental is just chemistry. It's applied chemistry, really. So that's why they get the awards.
Because is there an award for biology? Because there's only physics, chemistry. So
there is physiology and medicine. Physiology or medicine, they call it. And so that's sort of the medical side of things. But no, you're right. There's nothing for sort of straight sort of biology, biochemistry, you know, that sort of thing. So that all gets encompassed in the chemistry award. So as you say, these two women basically developed this thing called CRISPR, and which I can never remember, clustered regularly interspersed short palindromic repeats.
Obviously.
Yeah, indeed. Now, what's this all about? So it's a really good story because it sort of shows the way that science works and that nobody really does science in isolation, that people are, as Newton said, standing on the shoulders of giants. So, or as Oasis said, standing on the shoulder of giants, I think. I think they kind of got it wrong. Anyway, way back in the sort of the late 80s, early 90s, it was just becoming the thing to look at DNA and try and sequence it, okay? And this has been done for, you know, many years longer than that. And in fact, the Nobel Prize had gone for the sequencing of DNA in about the 1980s or something, I think. And DNA basically contains our genetic information. It's a four-letter code, so A, T, G, C. That's our four-letter alphabet, basically. And we get millions and millions, in some cases, of these base pairs that are signified by A, C, G, T. And those instructions, or the way in which they are situated along the DNA chain, basically are the instructions to make us us, okay? And to make rats rats, and to make shellfish, and all that sort of stuff. And so people were studying the DNA of bacteria and archaea, which are other sort of single-cell organisms. And they were sort of getting a good handle on what the sort of different bits of DNA meant, or the different sequences along the DNA chain. But what they found was these regularly repeating little clusters, as they were, of DNA, okay? And what they found was that, you get these little clusters, about 10 to 30-odd base pairs, that kept repeating. And then they were separated by short bits of sort of DNA that had no sort of regular pattern to them. And then another one, again, separated by another bit of DNA, and another, and another, and another. And so these sort of went on for, 10, 20, sort of 30 times. And they couldn't figure out what the purpose of this really was. And so this was first sort of identified by a Japanese researcher in about 1987. And then in the 90s, one guy in particular, a Spanish guy by the name of Francisco Mojica, forgive my pronunciation. He sort of studied this in organisms in Spain. And he worked and worked and worked. He was trying to figure out what the heck all of this was. You know, why were these sort of regular repeating segments of DNA in the genome of a particular species, okay? And he figured out eventually that these regular repeating bits came, in fact, from viruses, amongst other things. And so what was actually happening was that, you know, your bacteria or your organism or whatever was being infected by a virus, it would then chop a bit of the DNA out of the virus and it would actually insert it into its own genome in repeating sections, bam, 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 with the idea being that it would then recognize that DNA if it got sort of attacked next time by a virus. You know, it's kind of pretty amazing stuff. Really incredible. And you sort of think, why the hell would an organism muck around with their own DNA, with their own genome? Why would they alter it? And this seems to be the reason that occurs. So this Spanish guy eventually got his paper published on this after a couple of rejections and stuff like that. And then the question then became, right, how do these organisms actually snip the DNA at particular sites? How do they take only these little bits, and precisely these little bits, chop them up, must chop up their own DNA as well, and insert them in these regular sort of spacings? And it was Charpentier and Doudna who figured out essentially how this could be done, or how they could utilize this process in the lab. So a long story short, what was doing the chopping was these proteins called Cas9 proteins, okay? And they figured out that, yeah, we can utilize these. We can take nature and actually use it to specifically chop up bits of DNA. And as soon as you can do that, as soon as you can start chopping up DNA in precise, definite positions, then you've got a very, very powerful tool for, as the Nobel Prize citation went, gene editing. You can now chop up DNA specifically. You can insert bits of DNA in DNA, you know, and you've obviously then got a very, very powerful tool.
Right, yeah, and some of the real life benefits they talk about for that for humans being stuff like, I mean, how can you use
that? They're talking about sickle cell anemia. That seems to be the important thing. So they're trying to, you know, they know genetic defect that then causes that. So, you know, can they then just chop that bit out of the DNA, right, and, you know, and basically fix it? And if you can do that, then that's extraordinarily powerful. And the really sad part of all of this was the sad story of a Lithuanian guy whose name I'm definitely going to mispronounce, Virginijus Šikšnis. And he was working on exactly the same thing as Charpentier and Doudna at exactly the same time. He got exactly the same results. He submitted his paper first to a journal called Cell, which is one of the top journals, and it got sent straight back to him without going to referees. So it basically got rejected. In the meantime, Doudna and Charpentier sent their paper to Science. It got accepted, so he got scooped on
this. And I think that's kind of the weird moral of this issue is, I mean, as you're saying, often with these complex developments, people are standing on the shoulders of giants. It's a team effort. So how do you really decide who is deserving of the Nobel Prize?
And that's something we'll never know, because we don't even know whether he was nominated, because those are not made public until 50 years after the award. So, you know, this year we'll find out who got nominated for the Chemistry Prize in 1970.
That's helpful.
You might think sort of about the Peace Prize and stuff like that. Well, you know, people go bloody nominating folk and then making it public, you know. So if Trump got nominated, blah, 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 blah. But in the sciences, no, that's all kept strictly secret and no correspondence is entered into. If you watch the live stream of the award, the question was put, did the committee give any thought to awarding this to any other person as well as these two? And they just said, well, I'm sorry, we don't answer those questions.
Yeah. Well, and that does kind of tie into as well our second topic we were going to also talk about today, which is Nobel Prize related, and maybe someone else, was part of contributing to the discoveries, but maybe missed out on the Nobel Prize, and that was a Kiwi himself, Roy Kerr. So we were talking about the Nobel Prize in Physics last week, and one of the recipients was Roger Penrose for his mathematical work on black holes in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And he was a contemporary of Stephen Hawking's, but there was also, Roy Kerr was doing the same thing at the same sort of time.
And this is the thing, he is just not known in this country. In the same way that Alec MacDiarmid, who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, wasn't known in this country until he won the prize. So Roy Kerr has won the Rutherford Medal, which is the highest scientific award in New Zealand. He's also won a very prestigious Swedish award in 2016 for his work on black holes. And he was the first guy basically to solve these Einstein equations, which came from Einstein, of course, in 1963 when he was at the University of Texas. And this was all to do with black holes. And basically he showed that black holes would rotate. We have these things called rotating black holes. And this was a theory until last year when they got the first photo, essentially, of a black hole, which I think we talked about on this program. And that confirmed Kerr's theory. So he was actually working on this problem prior to Penrose. And, you know, he would have to have been nominated for this because this work was just incredibly important, you know, and he was the one that got there first. But, you know, in the vagaries of the discussion of how this is awarded and everything, he obviously didn't get it. And, you know, this is probably his one shot at it. He is getting on in years now, sort of 80-something and everything. I had the great fortune of organising a symposium once upon a time where he and all the other Rutherford medalists gave a talk. And I would have to admit, again, I didn't really know about his great work and stuff. I think, look, this, if we're giving out knighthoods and stuff like that, which we do, I mean, come on, give this guy a knighthood. This guy is a scientific powerhouse, you know. He's world class. And he didn't get the Nobel Prize, but by God, he must have been really, really, really close to it. So, you know, to be a fly on the wall at those deliberations.
Yeah, and because they did already split that prize, that physics prize, in half, so I guess.
Yeah, so it went three ways, two halves. So a half to Penrose, and then a half to two other ways. Workers who actually did the physical sort of the telescopes and stuff like that. So they're actually doing the experimental part, and Penrose got it for the theoretical part. Kerr could have got it for the theoretical part as well. He really could have. So. Okay, so Jacinda, if you're listening, New Year's honours list, okay?
Please, yeah. Yeah, so, whoever gets into government this weekend when we find out.
I'm prefacing things there, aren't I? Yes, goodness me, yes.
Yeah, well, so, and then maybe I guess we'll have to wait 50 years to find out if he was even nominated, but by that point I guess it's a bit late.
Yep, it absolutely is. But, you know, suffice to say, Kiwis can do great science, regardless of the fact that we're this little isolated backwater, you know, on the edge of the earth. We've got extraordinary minds, you know. We've got truly great scientists. So this is just another just a recognition of that, I guess.
Cool. Thank you so much, Ellen. Well, that's everything we've got for Dear Science today. We will be back, everyone, after a short break.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology. A lot of